From the macabre minds of Laughing Devil Production comes another story from the Nightshade Diary. You know what that means. Check under the bed and make sure no one or nothing is there. Is the closet door securely shut? Then leave your disbelief behind, amp up your imagination, and hang on tight for another ride into terror and mystery. And like all good horror stories, just imagine it's a dark and stormy night. And remember, screaming like a little girl is permitted. The Former Passengers by B.M. Croker. Who is whispering and calling through the rain, far above the tempest crashing, and the torrent's ceaseless dashing, I hear a weary calling as of pain. If anyone can help you, it will be Captain Blaine. This sentence was uttered by a smart young clerk in a shipping office in Rangoon, who, clothed in cool white drill, leant his elbows confidentially on the desk and concluded his speech with a reassuring nod. I was en route from Upper Burma to Singapore in order to attend my sister's wedding. Our flat river boat was late, and when I presented myself at the booking office of the P&O, I found to my dismay that the steamer for the Straits had sailed at dawn, and that there would be not another one for a week. I was therefore bound to miss the wedding and waste my precious leave in Rangoon, thanks to the leisurely old tub that had dawdled down from Mandalay. I turned my eyes expectantly on Captain Blaine, a short-necked, weather-beaten sailor in a blue serge coat with gilt buttons and a peaked cap. He surveyed me steadily with a pair of small, keen eyes, and evidently did not receive the suggestion with enthusiasm. "We don't carry passengers," he announced in a gruff voice. "My ship is only a cargo boat, a tramp, and we have no accommodation whatsoever." "No accommodation?" echoed the clerk incredulously. "Oh, I say, come. Why, you know very well that all the cabins are chock full of cargo, and we have never carried a passenger since I took command. If there was any hole or corner where you could stow me, I don't mind how I rough it," I urged, "and I'll pay full first-class fare." "Oh, there's a lot of holes and corners," admitted the captain, "and you just get the ship's rations, same as the officers and myself. No soups and entrees, plain roast and boiled. I'm not particular. I'm ready to eat salt junk and sea biscuit. I'll do anything short of swimming to get to Singapore by next Wednesday." "Is it so very important?" demanded Captain Blaine. "A wedding? No, no, an answer to his commiserating stare, not my own, but I've to give away the bride." "Well, I suppose I must try and stretch a point. Mind, I'll take you at your word about the passage money. Never refuse a good offer in my motto. So, Mr. And he paused questioningly. "Lawrence is my name." "Mr. Lawrence, if you'll be down at Godwin's Wharf tomorrow at 9 o'clock with your baggage and bedding and servant, we will lie off a bit. And any sampan will put you aboard in 5 minutes. Ask for the Wandering Star. And with a nest between the clerk and myself," he turned his back and stumped out. "He is not very keen about passengers," remarked the clerk with a laugh. "I wonder why." "I suppose because she is a dirty old cargo boat. But any port in a storm, or rather any ship, in this crisis for me." "Ah," said the clerk, rubbing his chin reflectively. "I've a sort of idea, though perhaps I dreamt it, that there is something rum or out of the way about this Wandering Star." "Well, whatever it is, I'll risk it," I answered, with a laugh as I followed the captain's example and took my departure. Punctually at 9 o'clock next morning, I embarked in a sampan and was rowed down the swift Irrawaddy. "That cannot be my steamer," I protested as the boatman made for a long, low, raking craft, a craft of considerable pretensions. She looked like one of the smaller vessels of the P&O fleet. But sure enough, the boatman was right, for as we passed under her stern, I read in yellow letters a name, Wandering Star. A closer inspection showed her to be simply what her commander had stated, a tramp. She was dirty, rusty, and travel-stained. When I clambered aboard, I found no snowy decks or shining brasses, but piles of cargo, bustling coolies, and busy blue-clad Lascars. I was immediately accosted by the captain, who presented me to the chief officer and to a fellow traveler, a sallow, lanky youth of 19, going to join his friends in the Straits. "I thought he would be company for you," explained the sailor. "We are off in half an hour," pointing to the Blue Peter at the fore, "and we're loaded to the hatches. Mr. Kelly here will show you your quarters." As I followed the chief officer, I was astonished at the dimensions of the Star. It was a considerable distance from the captain's snug cabin near the bridge to the poop. We made our way below into a long saloon with tables and seats intact, but the aft part piled high with bales. There was a strange, musty, moldy smell. It felt damp and vault-like, and afforded a sharp contrast to the blazing sun and cobalt sky on deck. As my eye became used to the gloom, I noticed the lavish carving, the handsome mahogany and brass fittings, the maple wood doors and panels, the remains of better days. My cabin contained two bunks, and in one of these my servant, a Madras butler, called Swami, had already arranged my bedding. "I wonder you don't carry passengers," I remarked to Mr. Kelly. "What a fine saloon. I should have thought it would have paid well." "She carried hundreds in her day," he said complacently. "You see, there is where the piano was hitched, and there the swinging lamps and bookcases. But all the same, it would never pay us to take passengers." And he laughed, an odd sort of laugh. "We are not a regular liner, you know, trading between two ports. Regular liners look on us as dirt, but lots of them would give a good deal for our lines and our engines. There's some of them I would not send my old boots home in. We pick up cargo as we find it. One time we run to Zanzibar, another to Hong Kong, another to the Cape, or maybe Sydney. I've not been home these 3 years. I hope you'll find your bunk comfortable. The youngster's opposite, just across the saloon. You know your way back." And having done the honors, he left me. Certainly the Star was much above her present business and bore the remains of having seen better days. Even my marble washstand was not in keeping with a cargo steamer. I opened the next cabin. It was crammed to the door with freight, bird cages in this instance. Every cabin was no doubt similarly packed. I was not sorry to exchange the earthy, chill atmosphere below for the bright sunshine on deck. Soon we had weighed anchor and were moving smoothly down the rapid Irrawaddy, between high banks of tawny grass, gradually losing sight of the shipping, then of the Golden Pagoda, then of Elephant Point. Finally the Star put her nose straight out to cross the Gulf of Martaban. The sea was calm. We were well fed and found, and made a pleasant party of six. The captain, first and second officers, the chief engineer, and two passengers. I slept like a top that night, and awoke next morning and found we were anchored off Mulmeen, with its hills covered with pagodas and palms. From Mulmeen we put to sea, and still the weather once more favored us. The captain was a capital companion, full of anecdotes and sea stories. The chief engineer was a first-rate chess player, and I began to think I had done rather a smart thing in securing a passage in this stray steamer. As the captain concluded a thrilling yarn apropos of a former ship in which he had been third officer, I suddenly recalled the shipping clerk's hint and asked, "Are there no stories about this one? Has she no history?" Captain Blaine looked at the chief officer with a knowing grin and then replied, "History? Of course she has. What do you call the logbook? That's her history. I suppose that chap at the office told you how she was considered an unlucky ship, Come now, own up." "No, but he said that he had an idea that there was something queer about her. He could not remember what it was." "Well, I've been in command of her now 4 years, and I've seen nothing to complain of. What do you say, Kelly?" appealing to the first officer. I say that I never wish to put foot on a better sea-boat, and there's nothing wrong with her as far as I know. Balsami, my Madras boy, entertained a totally different opinion of the star. When I asked him why he did not sleep outside my door in the saloon, he frankly replied, "Because plenty devil in this ship. The chief Sarang, head of the Lascars, telling me that saloon plenty bad place." We were now within 48 hours of Singapore, when the weather suddenly changed, as it frequently does in those treacherous seas. The awning was taken down, sure presage of a bad time coming. The ports were closed and always made ready for a blow, and we were not disappointed. It came. We had a rough night, but I was not in the least inconvenienced. I slept like a dormouse, rocked in the cradle of the deep. In the morning, my fellow passenger, whose name, by the way, was Mellish, and who had evidently suffered to judge by his ghastly appearance, accosted me timidly and said, "Did you get up and walk about last night?"
"No."
"Do you ever walk in your sleep?" he continued.
"Not to my knowledge. Why?"
"Because last night someone came and hammered on my cabin door and shouted, 'The ship's aground.'"
"What do you think it can have been?" he asked with a frightful face.
"I think there's no doubt that it was the hot tin lobster you had for supper," I answered promptly. "No, no, no, it was not a dream. It woke me," he returned. "I thought it was you. Then I tried to think it was a nightmare, and I had almost brought myself to believe it and was dropping off to sleep, when a cold, cold, wet hand was passed slowly across my face," and he shuddered violently.
"Lobster," I repeated emphatically.
"No, no, Mr. Lawrence, I heard moaning and whispering and praying. I'm afraid to sleep in that cabin alone. May I come and share yours?"
"There is no room," I answered rather shortly. "The top berth is crammed full of my things."
At breakfast there was a good deal of movement, and now and then a loud splash upon the deck. The captain, who had been tapping the barometer, looked unusually solemn and said, "We are in for a bit of dirty weather, unless I'm mistaken. There's a cyclone somewhere about. I don't think we shall do more than touch the edge of it, and this is a stout craft, so you need not be uneasy." This was vastly reassuring. When the sky to the west changed from a lowering gray to an inky blank, the wind rose with a whimper that increased to a shriek. It lashed the sea with fury, lashed it into enormous waves, and laden as we were, we began to roll, at first majestically, then heavily, then helplessly. We took in great green seas over the bows. Tons of water discharged themselves amidships. I made a stagger and groan, but still through it all the engines thumped doggedly on. We seized our dinner anyhow, sitting, standing, kneeling, adapting ourselves to the momentary angle of the vessel. It was a miserable evening, wet and cold, and Mellish and I went to bed early. The deadlights were down, the hatchway closed behind us. We were entirely cut off from the rest of our shipmates for the night, and the saloon smelt more vault-like than ever. I turned away from Mellish's gray, frightened face, and stammering piteous importunities, shut myself into my cabin, bolted the door, went to bed, and fell asleep. Meanwhile, the storm increased to a hurricane. The motion was tremendous. I was flung violently out on the floor as the star made one awful plunge, and then righted itself. I was, needless to state, now thoroughly awake, and scrambling back into my berth, and clinging to the woodwork with both hands, lay listening to the roaring of the tempest, which rose now and then to a shrill shriek that had a terrible human sound. My heart beat fast, as my ears assured it that I was not merely listening to the raving of the gale, but actually to the piercing screams of women and the hoarse shouts of men. Just as I had arrived at this amazing conclusion, the door to the cabin was burst open, and an elderly man, in his shirt sleeves, was hurled in. "She's going down," he bawled excitedly, "and the hatches are fast." I sprang up, and the next lurch shot us both out into the saloon, and what a scene did I behold by three lamps
that swung violently to and fro. Their fitful light showed me a large number of half-dressed strangers in the last extremity of mortal fear. There was the horrible, selfish pushing and struggling of a panic-stricken crowd, fighting their way towards a companion ladder, the wild, frenzied distraction people exhibit when striving to escape from some deadly peril, the tumult, the cries and shrieks of frightened women making frantic appeals for rescue, cries heart-rending to hear. Besides the dense, struggling block at one end of the cabin, battling fiercely for escape, there were various groups, apparently resigned to their impending fate. A family at prayer, two men drinking raw brandy out of tumblers, Anaya beating her head upon the floor and calling on Ramaswamy, an old lady with a shawl over her head and a Bible on her knee, a young man and a girl, hand locked in hand, whispering last words, a pale woman with a sleeping child in her arms. I saw them all. I saw Mellish clinging to the saloon handrail, his eyes glazed with horror and gibbering like an idiot. The crash of broken crockery, the shrieks of despair, the roaring of the wind, the sullen thundering of the seas overhead, combined to make up the most frightful scene that could possibly be imagined. Then all at once, a beautiful girl with long dark hair, streaming over a white gown, rushed out of a cabin and threw herself upon me. Flinging her arms round my neck, she sobbed, "Oh, save me, save me! Don't let me die, don't let me die!" Her wild, agonized face was pressed closely to mine. Her frantic clasp round my neck tightened like a band of steel. Closer, closer, closer. I was choking. I could not move or breathe. She was strangling me as she shrieked in my ear, "It is coming now. This is death." There was one awful lurch, a grinding crash, a sinking sensation, a vice-like grip about my throat, and outer darkness. I was aroused in broad daylight by Sawami, who had brought my tea and shaving water. I was lying on the floor of the saloon, and he was stooping over me with a frightened expression on his broad brown countenance. "At first I thinking master dead," was his candid announcement. "Me plenty freighting. Why master lying here and no in bed? Why indeed?" A plunge of my head into cool water and a cup of tea brought me to myself, and then I flung on my dressing gown and hurried across the saloon to see what had become of the miserable Mellish. He was stretched in his berth with a life belt beside him, rigid and cold and in a sort of fit. With brandy, burnt brown paper, and great difficulty, Sawmy and I brought him round. As soon as he had come to his senses and realized he was still in the land of the living, he sat up and turned on me quite ferociously and said, "And that's what you call lobster?" The weather had moderated considerably, and though I had no great appetite, I was able to appear at breakfast. Mellish was too shattered to join us and lay in a long chair in the deck house, sipping beef tea and hysterically assuring all inquirers that he would never again set foot in the saloon. No, he would much rather die. "I suppose you got knocked about a bit last night?" inquired the captain with a searching glance. "Not exactly knocked about. I did not mind that so much, but..." and I hesitated. "But you were disturbed?" he added significantly. "Yes, very much so. I hope I shall never be disturbed in such a way again." "Then I take it you've seen them?" "The former passengers? They are generally aboard, they say, in dirty weather." "Whatever they were, I trust in God I may never witness such another scene." "You don't wonder now that we are not free of offering cabin accommodation, Not that I ever saw anything myself." "But you admit that there is something?" "So they say," nodding his head with a jaunty air. "And what is the explanation?" "What do they say?" I asked impatiently. "Just this. The Wandering Star was once the Atalanta, a fine passenger steamer, and coming out her last trip, she fell in for the tail of a cyclone and came to grief off the Lacedives. Blown out of her course, engine fires put out, went on a rock and sank in 10 fathoms. Every soul on board went down, except a steward and a fireman who got off on a hen coop. It was an awful business. 69 passengers, besides officers and crew. She sank like a stone. No time to get battered to pieces. And so she was right, well worth her salvage. A company bought her cheap. She was but little damaged. They raised and sold her. She was intended for the pilgrim traffic, from Bombay to Mecca. And in fact, she did make a couple of trips. But somehow she got a bad name. The pilgrims said she was possessed of devils. Ha ha! And so the owners put her into the wheat and rice and general cargo trade. And we have no complaints. She has been at it these 5 years and is, as I take you to witness, a grand sea boat and has fine accommodation between decks as well as aft. It's only in real dirty weather that there is anything amiss, and that in the saloon. They say, lowering his voice to a hoarse whisper, they kept the passengers below, battened down. They got no chance for their lives. It was a mistake. They were all drowned like rats in their holes. Mind you, I've seen nothing, and I'm not a superstitious man. Would you sleep in the saloon? I sternly demanded. No. For in a blow, my place is on the bridge. But I'll not deny that a second officer who has left us tried a bunk down there once, out of curiosity, and did not repeat the experiment. He was properly scared, and the captain chuckled at the recollection. I suppose we shall get in tonight, I remarked, as we paced the deck together. Yes, about 11 o'clock. We are doing our 12 knots, dirty-looking old hooker as we are. So much the better, I answered, for you will not be surprised to hear that I'm not anxious to occupy my berth again. I am thankful to relate that I slept on land that same night and was not disturbed. I often glance at the shipping list to see if there's any news of the Wandering Star. I know that she is still tramping the ocean from China to Peru, and I have not the smallest doubt but that on stormy nights the saloon is still crowded with the distractor specters of her former passengers.